Our second case on the March calendar, but before I call it, I want to welcome, on behalf of the court, some high school students who are with us today. We have students from West High School. Would they please stand? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. And we have students from Craig High School. Would they stand? Good seeing you all, and you may be seated. The students are here with us with the Court with Class program. It's a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The students have received briefs in the case we're about to hear, and they may have received other materials and may have met with people about this case. And as part of the Court with Class program, the students will meet with a justice of the court at noon, or at least after this case is completed. The justice will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case, and everyone, students and others, are welcome to join that session at noon, and the students here now will be joined by other students who were here this morning and maybe some who are coming this afternoon. Now, the justice with whom you're going to meet today is Justice John Wilcox, who is seated to my immediate right. And let me introduce the rest of the court to you. On my far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Judge David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right, I've already introduced him, Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And ordinarily, the empty chair is occupied by Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, let me call the second case, 03-0662, Cesar Bosco versus Lurk, and appearing for AT Polishing Company and Shelby Insurance Company is Michael C. Froman. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Mike Froman, and I represent the defendants and the appellants and the petitioners in this case, AT Polishing Company and Shelby Insurance Company. Shelby also goes by the names Insura and Anthem. This case is similar in many respects to the Kelly Brown versus Reliance case that was decided by the court last fall. They both involve a decision by the Labor and Industry Review Commission, also known as LIRC, on the issue of bad faith claims handling. In this case, we're dealing with a dispute over the interpretation of a statute involving appeal procedure. In the Kelly Brown case, of course, the dispute was over the sufficiency of evidence necessary to suspend benefit payments. In both cases, the LIRC found there was no bad faith on the part of the insurance carrier, and in both cases, that decision was overturned by a reviewing court. I believe the controlling doctrine in Brown was that reviewing courts must give great weight deference to LIRC's reasonable conclusions of law in the area of bad faith penalties. The application of that doctrine to this case calls for a similar result, the reinstatement of the LIRC order. Mr. Bosco's claim for...
Counselor, I assume, you know, when you apply the great weight deference standard, which is what you're asking us due to the statutory interpretation, that you want us to conclude that there was a reason other than coverage that Shelby had for not making payments. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
What's the reason?
Liability. The coverage and liability and workers' compensation are, you know, can have different meanings.
Tell me how.
Shelby did not dispute coverage with its insured. The coverage was always in place. What Shelby did was deny the compensability, the liability of the underlying benefit claim based on a date of injury found in 1996.
Yeah, but that's a coverage question. It's whether or not you were providing insurance on the date you say the injury occurred, correct?
We had no dispute that we provided insurance on the date determined by the commission.
Which date is that?
1996 was the date of injury found.
What about 93? Did you insure the AT then?
We did not.
Okay. If you didn't insure, here's my problem. Do your two clients, AT Polishing and Shelby, have different interests here?
Justice, I believe they do not. Presentation today is to emphasize the importance of Section 102.03, which states the conditions of liability under the Workers' Compensation Act have to do with when the date of injury occurs. Liability follows date of injury. You cannot have the point is that three or four sections under 102.03 refer to the date of injury as when liability sets.
Let me just ask you this. Suppose the date of injury was 1993. Let's just suppose that. Is AT liable for workers' comp if the date of injury is 1993?
We don't know that, Judge.
Why not?
Because that issue hasn't been tried before the department or the commission.
What would make them not liable?
If, for example, on the date of injury back in 1993, the employee wasn't an employee, the employer wasn't an employer covered under the Act, if at that time the employee wasn't performing services growing out of and incidental to the employment, all benefit rights are determined as of a particular date and time, the time of injury. When I challenge on behalf of Shelby and my employer client, AT Polishing, that liability does not exist in 1996, I do not concede anything else. I don't concede that liability does exist in 1993. I say there is no liability for either the carrier or the employer in 1996. If I win that argument, that application for benefits is dismissed out against both the employer and the carrier, and then the applicant must pursue a different line.
I thought that you conceded permanent total disability and that the permanent total disability was caused by the occupational exposure.
Justice, I realize that that has been repeated many times, and I have to say it is not correct. We have always disputed liability for the 1996 date of injury, and we never conceded that any date of injury created permanent and total disability.
Well, for instance, the findings of fact of the Labor and Industry Review Commission, the first page, says Shelby Mutual did not contest, but that's not what I'm looking for. I think it is with regard to the finding of facts and perhaps the lower court opinions also. Both led me to believe that you were not disputing that this was a permanent total disability and that you were not disputing that it was an occupational injury. So I want to know for sure that's not correct, and then tell me what can you point to in the record with regard to either your answer or the transcript at the hearing that suggests otherwise.
The answer is located on page 147 of the brief, the appendix.
And I can't point to what the findings in the examiner, but as I read it, indicated that initially you contested it, but then at the hearing you didn't. That's what they said.
I think I understand what you're referring to, Justice Bradley. When this case proceeded on the benefit track, beyond the administrative law judge and then beyond the commission into the courts.
Mm-hmm.
I said I concede that what we're pursuing here is a legal issue, the date of injury issue. What I am not contesting at this point in the proceedings is the finding of total disability based on the occupational exposure. Yeah, and that is found in my reply brief to the circuit court in the benefit case. And I know that that has been referred to by counsel for Mr. Bosco as a concession of liability. I say it isn't. It's simply refining the issues for judicial appeal. It is quite well known that findings of fact are made by the commission and that legal issues can proceed.
This is important then. Are you disputing permanent total disability? Are you disputing that the plaintiff is a permanent total disability?
I'm not disputing that Mr. Bosco is permanently and totally disabled.
And I don't mean now, I mean what the record reflects. Are you disputing that he's permanently and totally disabled as a result of an occupational injury?
No.
So you're not disputing that, and you're not disputing that it was caused by an occupational injury, and this is the only place he's worked, so you're not disputing it was caused by this industry, are you?
I am not.
Okay, so you're not? Nope. The nature and extent of disability and causation are not in dispute.
Nature and extent of disability are not in dispute. Those are factual findings determined by the commission.
And you're not disputing that it was caused and that the disability was caused by occupational exposure.
I am disputing that the occupational exposure claimed caused his permanent and total disability. And the occupational exposure claimed was the 1996 date of injury.
Okay, so this is important, and it seems like I really have to understand this, and I have to understand where you are. And so I get back to, I think, where I started, but you disputed that initially. To me, you are only disputing the date upon which there was the date of injury. You are not disputing the nature and extent of the injury or that it was caused by the occupational exposure. You are disputing only the date of injury. Is that correct?
On appeal to the courts, that is correct.
Excuse me. I want to follow up now. Because the question was asked, you're representing both AT Polishing and Shelby, and this was kind of an aside with the Chief Justice, but how can you represent, in other words, AT was the employer. They relied on your representation, and maybe this is what's confusing to me.
Well, that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, and the answer is, how you're saying, well, look, we're representing AT, and this, but in 93, we're not, you, Shelby, are not liable, but AT could be. AT
could be.
Yeah, but AT is also liable, but in 96, and I'm just looking here, and if this is wrong, tell me that in your answer, you said that the occupational exposure alleged in the application occurred on or about 1996. That's what you put in your answer, but you argued that it occurred in 93. But where is AT with that type of that representation?
If I can provide an example, in workers' compensation, there's two classifications of injury, the accidental injury, the occupational disease injury. There's no problem with this issue with the accidental injury. Everyone knows when that happens. In occupational disease cases, the case law describes, especially the Kohler case is good on this, says there's a problem here because there's a continuum of exposure over a long period of time, sometimes with multiple employers. There is a beginning to the process. There is a time when symptoms begin, but there's no disability. There's a time when it ripens into a disabling affliction. And the subject of many, many appellate cases in this area has been, when is that date? And so it's a troublesome concept in workers' compensation, the date of injury for occupational disease. So frequently we have hearings where there is perhaps a single employer and three carriers sitting there defending, for example, and each one of those carriers hires a lawyer. The lawyer is representing the carrier and the employer for that date of injury. So you can have at a single hearing two or three different counsel, each of them representing the employer, but for a specific date of injury.
Counselor, isn't the different representations you're describing because different insurance companies would have coverage on those different dates?
That's correct.
Okay, well then how come the issue you're presenting to us isn't a coverage issue?
My understanding of a coverage issue, as this particular statute has in mind, pursuant to that 1929 footnote to the Industrial Commission case, if there's a question of insurance coverage, I interpret that to mean if liability is established as of a particular time, who is responsible to make payments?
Well, and that's why you have, in your example that you gave us, three different insurance companies, because any one of three could be liable depending on the date of injury that was determined. And I understand that, but I fail to see the difference between that and the issue you're bringing to us, because what you're saying is we don't have liability on that date, but it interprets to me as we don't have any coverage for that date. We weren't the insurer. You have to look to somebody else.
I think the reviewing courts took that approach, Your Honor, and I think that is a mistaken view. I think that the view is that a coverage issue is trying to find out who's responsible to pay benefits when all other questions have been resolved. What I'm bringing to you is the contention that all other issues have not been resolved. There's a date of injury issue here, and that necessarily determines who might be responsible. And that issue cannot finally determine the matter. And I think this is where the reviewing courts made the error. They say that liability is fixed. All we have to do is figure out which insurance carrier must pay the benefits. I think that's an error because liability isn't fixed by simply finding the 1996 date of injury. You know, if there is a contest, if the medical evidence points to a different date, liability isn't fixed. Because if I win that argument, you know, we go back to the beginning, and whoever might be responsible has an opportunity to defend that claim.
What happens in the meantime to AT Polishing and any obligation they might have to Mr. Bosco?
In the situation where I refer, where liability is in question because there's a date of injury dispute, the insured AT Polishing is not obligated to make payments on its own.
So where do you, under 103.23.5, mm-hmm. And if I read that, it seems to be fairly clear that during review that either the insurance carrier or the employer would have to make that payment. That's the argument. I don't want to make the argument on the other side, but I'm just saying that if, from what I can discern here, that you're trying to go back to 93, but you had no problem with the coverage or the liability issue, excuse me, from 96 on.
That's correct. I mean, if the commission made its finding that Shelby was liable because there was a 1996 date of injury, there's absolutely no dispute between AT Polishing and Shelby. That's why I say there's no coverage issue. We never denied coverage. We have the policy. We will pay for 1996.
But what happens in the meantime to the Mr. Bosco? This started, say, allegedly in 96, is now 2004. That's 8 years.
His claim was presented in 1997, and the first hearing was held in 1998. And
if, 6 years.
If I, if I, Sometimes the proceedings take time, and that's why there is, you know, there are interest provisions in the Act calling for payment to Mr. Bosco of interest if there is an appeal and the appeal fails, and then you do have to pay interest to him for the period of time it takes to process the appeal. But the appeal rights are set forth in 10223, and my client chose to file that appeal. We think the commission mistakenly found the date of injury, and that was our argument. And because we made that argument, we challenged liability. There's no liability under the Act if the commission got the date of injury wrong.
Counsel, when did Bosco start as an employee for AT Polishing, Inc.?
I believe 1987.
I don't know. Is it your contention that the occupational exposure commenced prior to 1987?
I don't recall his entire history. I know he only worked for AT Polishing from 1987 to 1996, and that's what I admitted in the answer. Okay. He had that occupational exposure.
Okay. Well, if you don't know, then I assume you're not asserting that it was caused by prior employment and prior employer, which gets me back to the questions that have been asked here regarding your representation of both the employer and the insurance company. I mean, it seems to me, from what you've responded, that AT Polishing is going to be on the hook, if you will, for this occupational injury, regardless if the date of injury is 1996 or 1993 or 1992 or 1991. So they're on the whole time, because you're not asserting, oh, it really occurred and was manifested sufficiently to be considered a date of injury prior to the employment commenced with AT Polishing. You're not asserting that.
No.
So they're on the hook. It's just a question of whether or not Shelby's on the hook.
That may be true. They may be on the hook. If the commission's decision finding Shelby and AT liable for 1996 gets reversed, for example, that doesn't mean AT Polishing is still automatically on the hook. Somebody needs to prove that there is a 1993 date of injury where they are both on the hook and both responsible at that time.
Why would the holding that AT and Shelby are liable under 96 be reversed? That's not the case before us. Isn't that case dead?
I lost that case, Your Honor.
That's right. The case that's before us is,
yes,
you were instructed to pay. That is, Shelby and AT were instructed that this is an occupational disease, it is attributable to the employment, and AT is liable, and you agree that in 96 you covered that?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't pay it, right?
We didn't pay the commission order right away when they ruled that, because we fought that.
Happened, right?
We fought that in the courts.
Did you instruct?
So somewhere along the line, the injured employee was not paid, right? Isn't that what this fight's about?
There is a delay in the payment,
okay.
Yes.
How long was there a delay? I don't care about the dates as much as I care about what procedures where were you in the procedure of this to delay it?
Well,
Seems to me you're trying to refight 93-96. They didn't allow you to amend it. They didn't allow you to do this. You lost. Now the question is, do you pay for bad faith?
Not because I lost the date of injury argument, but because I in the normal course of workers' compensation litigation, you pay when you lose your last appeal.
Okay.
This is a special statute which is alleged to come into play that is alleged to apply in these circumstances, which in the argument on the penalty track of this case was that the section really doesn't apply to a case where you're disputing a date of injury. It applies to the sort of case where there is agreement that liability exists as of a certain date, but we're not sure whether the employer had coverage or who it had coverage with. And that's why when the commission issued the order that's under review now, it recognized the administrative difficulties here in a way that the reviewing courts did not. Both the commission decisions stated that if an earlier date of injury were to be found, it wouldn't be a simple matter of choosing which of several payors who are parties to a claim must pay. It would be a matter of starting all over. And the commission recognized that. That's why it makes sense that 102.23.5 should apply in the situation where it's a simple mechanical checking to see who's got the coverage as of a certain date, and then we'll make that person pay. It does not make that much sense to apply it in a case like this when the ultimate liability is being challenged by date of injury.
Counselor, what if there had been another insurance company joined, and so it was you and Wausau Insurance, and they were the company that provided coverage in 1993, and the determination of the commission was the same. 1996 is the date of injury.
Yes.
But you still want to appeal that.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And do you think that the result would be the same and you're not involved in a coverage dispute?
I think the result would be different if the 1993 carrier were there.
Why?
Because in that sense, there would have to be, as LIRC recognized in its order, you wouldn't have to go back to begin the case all over again. You could pick the 1993 carrier because it was there, due process rights were allowed, it defended itself, and this is frequently the case in workers' compensation litigation, that there are multiple carriers sitting there. And evidence is presented from the medical providers, and the judge figures out which date of injury to nail. And there can be date of injury disputes following that, but if you've got both parties sitting at the table, it's a relatively simple matter for the commission to reassess and say, okay, we chose 96, but in reality the court tells us it's 93, so we'll make the 93 carrier pay. In that situation, I would say 102.23.5 does require the carrier assessed at the time of the hearing to pay before appealing to the courts, because in that sense, liability will certainly befall one of those two carriers, and there's no sense making Mr. Bosco wait for his money. But in the sense when there's one carrier, as there was here, and a date of injury defense was put forth, it's not a simple matter of reassignment.
But Counselor, that if I interpret the statute that way, that permits insurance companies to choose not to implead a fellow insurance company or try to get them involved in the lawsuit, because then nobody's going to have to pay the employee. And to me, the statute looks as though it's to protect the employee and to be sure they're paid while the insurance companies duke it out about who's going to be ultimately responsible.
It's not a matter of the insurance companies duking it out. It's a matter of the claimant proving his claim against a particular date of injury against an employer and a carrier.
Right, but certainly the employer knew who its carrier was back in 1993.
I agree, Justice, and I agree that it is a much more efficient process to have all the parties there from the beginning, but I have to point out that workers' compensation practice is different from civil practice in that not everything is cut and dried at the time of the hearing. The medical evidence that determines these sorts of liabilities for date of injury can come into evidence as late as 2 weeks before the hearing by report, And a doctor can testify at the hearing without any notice to anybody that he's going to be there. Sometimes the claimant will stand up at the hearing and testify, oh, I forgot, I really missed some time from work a year or two ago for the same condition. And at that point, when that kind of evidence is submitted in a workers' comp hearing, the judge says, well, Mr. Applicant's attorney, you've just heard your client say something here that I think we need to bring another party in because we don't have that carrier here. And this is what frequently happens in workers' compensation occupational disease cases, that you start out on a certain premise and that the facts at the hearing change that premise, and you have to be flexible and allow the other carrier to come in. It does require some delay, but that's what happens frequently. It didn't happen here.
Because the hearing examiner said, although you want to change it now that you're at hearing, I'm not going to allow this 11th-hour amendment.
And, Justice, I must take issue with the phrase amendment. I wasn't trying to amend the answer. The answer admitted occupational exposure. There was no doubt as to that. That the answer doesn't even use the word date of injury. I didn't intend to admit a particular date of injury. My intention at that hearing originally was to bring to the judge's attention the fact that we had medical evidence sitting on the table pointing to a different date of injury, and wouldn't it be a good idea to bring that other carrier in before proceeding? And the judge says, no, I think let's go ahead. We've got enough evidence in the record. I'll just go ahead.
Counsel, if you're representing both Shelby and AT Polishing, when you admitted that this was an occupational situation, in other words, the 96, did you advise them that they should not pay benefits? I'm talking about, did you advise the employer that they shouldn't pay benefits?
An insured employer never pays benefits. It's the insurance company that has the responsibility. And so this whole business about AT Polishing having any responsibility to issue benefit checks, I think, is unheard of in our practice. If it fails to do some act, the department and the act says that it may be penalized. It has responsibilities. I'm not denying that. But when a company abides by the insurance requirements of the Workers' Compensation Act under 10230, its carrier speaks for it. And so there's no distinction between the two clients in this circumstance. When I'm sitting at the table representing the two parties, my two clients are the collectively called the respondent, and they have no distinct interests on a date of injury issue.
They do with regard to, like, a delayed payment issue. I mean, they're not always, and this is date of injury, maybe. This is maybe a bad, I'm not sure if it's a date of injury issue as the case is before us now, as opposed to a bad faith.
Yes.
But in delayed payment, there can be a determination that, oh, it was the employer,
yes,
not the insurance company, that was responsible.
Yes.
And therefore, the employer has to pay for,
yes,
collection fees, finance, no, charge, et cetera, not the insurance
in
company.
In fact, the bad faith statute says that exactly, that the employer may be responsible for paying the bad faith penalty if it is found to be responsible. The responsibilities given to the employer are sometimes distinct from the responsibilities given to the carrier under the Act. If they are delinquent in reporting the injury to the carrier so that first payment is delayed, for example, it's the employer who must pay that penalty. And I'm not standing here to say that the employer never pays anything under the Act. They do have responsibilities. But in this situation where AT's carrier, Shelby, is battling a date of injury dispute, AT does not have to come forward and pony up the money to Mr. Bosco.
Do you have a case that you can cite to that, or you're saying that's just the general impression?
I'm thinking of the Travelers Insurance carrier case cited in the briefs, where it says that if a single employer has successive insurance carriers through the relevant period of time, that liability will be fixed at a certain point. There's a rule about that. So the system does anticipate that a single employer will have over the years successive insurance carriers. And that is why in occupational disease cases like this, we frequently have a row of defense attorneys trying to defend their date of injury. And sometimes they try to push the blame on another carrier. In my case, I attempted at the very beginning at the hearing to say, I think we need another carrier in here. Because if Mr. ALJ, if you rule that it's a 1993 injury, like I believe the medical reports suggest, Mr. Bosco is not going to get paid by anybody. The judge would not have the authority at that point to say, well, since AT Polishing was in the room by Mr. Frohman, that AT has to pay any date that we happen to find. And my authority for that is 102.03. The very conditions of liability depend on a date of injury. You don't have liability in general for an occupational exposure. You have liability for a particular date of injury, and that rules the whole Workers' Compensation Act.
I have a question. At the end of the Court of Appeals opinion, it says it goes back to LIRC, and LIRC is going to make determinations as to whether this was bad faith.
Yes.
And it looks like the Brown case. It looks like the Kelly case.
Yes.
All right, when it goes back. And then it says LIRC will be free to consider all factors except the legal issue. And LIRC is going to determine whether AT, Shelby, or both are liable for bad faith penalties.
Yes.
If there's liability for bad faith penalties, if this sticks, who pays them?
Shelby.
Is that covered by the insurance company?
Yes, Shelby. Well, it's Shelby pays if we go back to the commission now and they hold a hearing on this and they're free to find whoever responsible.
Suppose they find AT responsible.
I can't imagine such a scenario.
No, but let's imagine it.
If the commission finds AT responsible, it would almost have to find that there was no insurance coverage in place, and therefore they had responsibility on its own, independent of its contract with Shelby, to make that payment.
You're saying the only issue as a matter of law is whether Shelby has been guilty of bad faith and that it will pay if it is found guilty. Is that right?
That's my in the circumstances of this case, yes. I think that the only issue here in terms of bad faith is whether Shelby should or should not have paid the benefits prior to its court appeals.
Okay.
I just do not see that AT Polishing has separate liability under these circumstances. That's one of the problems I had with the Court of Appeals case.
Right.
And and if I can just add one thing, Justice, to your question. When the Court of Appeals said that the LIRC can reconsider bad faith and go back to square one on this, that isn't really true. I think the Court of Appeals basically placed the noose around the neck and it left it to the commission to pull the lever because in terms of finding bad faith, the Court of Appeals found that Shelby acted unreasonably, and then it remanded to the commission to apply the penalty. I believe that is a backdoor way around the Brown decision, where the Court of Appeals has, in essence, overturned LIRC on its bad faith ruling and then told it to go back again and find a different way.
We can debate that
okay. When
you come up again.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Gregory A. Pitts, representing Cesar Bosco.
May it please the court. My name is Gregory Pitts. I'm from the law firm of Shuny, Light, Kelly, Pitts, and Kinnear in Racine, Wisconsin, and I represent the plaintiff respondent, Cesar Bosco. I'm compelled to respond to some of counsel's arguments and am astutely aware of the fact that this court seems to understand what is going on in this case. First, I'd like to address counsel's argument that liability was contested in this case. It certainly was not. The court can look as far back as the original hearing date, at which time the ALJ noted that defense counsel was willing to concede an occupational illness occurred, and that it was merely asking for an extension of time so it could think about adding another insurance carrier to help, quote, carry the load. This is obviously a case where Shelby Insurance Company did not want to pay what ET Polishing owed. In fact, the ALJ noted that the only issues at that time were the extent of the disability claimed. It was not a case where the insurance company or the employer was arguing against causation. Following the ALJ's decision in favor of Mr. Bosco, the employer and insurance carrier appealed to LIRC, and on that appeal, it was willing to concede both causation and permanent total disability. The only issue on appeal before LIRC was the date of disability, and that has been the only appeal in this case since that time. In fact, in its brief to the Circuit Court of Kenosha County following LIRC's decision, defense counsel stated the issues in its issue section that it was willing that the plaintiff did not dispute the finding of permanent total disability as a result of an occupational illness. It was merely disputing the date of disability. So from that point on, AT Polishing's liability was fixed. As the case of Maryland Casualty Company stated, which was a long time ago but was raised by defense counsel, an employer's liability is fixed once there is either a concession of causation or the commission or the department finds that causation was established and that issue is not appealed. There was some talk about the standard of review in this case, and defense counsel submitted that this case was similar to the Kelly Brown case. I submit to you it is not at all similar. In that case, this court was looking at evidence of bad faith and had to afford great weight deference to LIRC. That was the proper decision in that case because LIRC has the expertise and experience with interpreting the bad faith statute. But in this case, the bad faith claim is based strictly on Wisconsin Statute 102.23 sub 5, which is perfectly applicable to this case, and I cannot imagine another statute more on point. It directs that the employer, meaning AT Polishing Company, must pay compensation when the only dispute on appeal is the question of liability between itself and its insurance company or between multiple insurance companies.
What does this case involve?
Excuse me?
What does this case involve? Where does it come under that language?
Present case?
Yeah.
This case is perfectly applicable because you look at the words of the statute. The commencement of action for review, meaning the commencement of action following LIRC to the circuit court, shall not relieve the employer from paying compensation as directed, meaning shall not relieve AT Polishing from paying, when such action involves only the question of liability between AT Polishing and Shelby.
And does it come under that clause, this case?
Yes.
Well, opposing counsel says it's not a question of liability between the employer and one and an insurance company. They're saying it's never been decided whether the employer is liable because the date of injury was 1993. Therefore, you have to go back and see whether your client was an employee, whether he was performing services, whether the disability occurred before 1993, that is before 87, when he wasn't even an employee of this company, right? I mean, that's what they're arguing.
That's what they're arguing, Your Honor, but frankly, it doesn't make any sense. If the employer and the insurance company show up at the initial hearing and are willing to concede that an occupational injury exists. They conceded causation. They are only disputing at the hearing the extent of the disability, not whether or not it was work-related.
Well, and you then, say that to me, but where do we find that? Now, I've looked at...
It's attached to the appendix of defense counsel's brief.
Right. 146 is what I refer to. No, okay. 147, yeah. Is it?
I'm not referring to 147, because 147 is the answer to the application. I'm looking at page 148,
okay,
which is the hearing notes. And on line 19, it begins, it, meaning Shelby Insurance Company, is now willing to concede that an occupational illness exists. And you turn the page, 149, beginning at line 14, it talks about what the issues were before the court that day, and the only issue was whether it was a permanent total disability claim or a permanent partial disability claim. So the only issue was extent of disability, not causation. Then that's just the first concession. You go to the Lurk decision, which is also attached to the appendix.
What page are we talking about now?
Well, first, I'll show you the decision of the ALJ. That was ALJ Jones on page 143.
Okay.
Second paragraph begins, the carrier now accepts that the applicant did sustain this work injury.
He says that's a mistake of fact, that it never accepted it.
Well, he hasn't argued that the administrative law judge misquoted him as saying it was willing to concede that an occupational illness exists, but was merely wanting to ask for extra time so it could think about adding another carrier to help carry the load.
Tell me why, since I know very little about workers' comp, tell me why you're not relying on 147. This is an admission to service and the answer to application. So the first one is admitted the accident or occupational exposure alleged actually occurred about the time claimed. You admitted that.
Right.
Admitted employer-employee. Admitted they were all subject to the workers' comp. Admitted that they were employee was performing services growing out of the employment. Denied that the accident causing injury rose out of the alleged employment, right?
That's right.
All right. Denied temporary disability. Denied disabled to the extent claimed. And denied the wage rate. So what does the denial and... in 5, how does that relate to the admission in...
Well, the answer and the application are filed much earlier than the date of hearing, usually several months. So at this time, I accept defense counsel's plausible argument that for number 1, it was merely admitting that the exposure took place as alleged in 1996,
okay,
without admitting that... there was causation that the employer was responsible. As for your question, number 5, yes, originally it disputed causation, whether or not it was work-related. But by the time we get to the hearing several months later, after more medical evidence is in the record, it now is willing to concede the occupational illness exists. That is a concession to liability.
Okay, but it's still at a relatively early date, but late. Wanted to bring in another insurance company because it wanted to say it all happened in 93 when it didn't have coverage, right?
Yes.
Okay. It wasn't able to do that.
That's right.
That issue is now dead, right?
That's right.
All right. So, but when they commenced the action for review, wasn't that an issue as to the question of liability? I'm going on to the next phrase.
No, it was, well, yes, it was. Are you talking about Wisconsin Statute 102.23 sub 5 now?
Yeah.
Yes.
I've talked to you about the question of liability as to between the employer and the insurance company. You don't think that was a question here because they conceded that, right?
Well, a question of liability in my mind means who is going to pay the employer's obligations. So, yes, it was a question of liability because the only fight was between Shelby and AT Polishing and some phantom insurance company that has never participated. So, yes, it was a question of liability, as the statute reads, between AT Polishing and one, meaning Shelby, or more insurance companies, or between several insurance companies. Okay. There was no dispute that about the fact that AT Polishing owed Bosco benefits, yet he was deprived of these benefits for over 26 months since the Lurk decision. And basically, we're a party, an involuntary party to these proceedings because it didn't matter to Bosco who was going to pay the benefits. All that we cared about was that they were received. The only difference any of that would have made would have been the difference in the rate of the payment between 1993 and 1996 and where the checks were coming from. But from
What's the difference in the rate?
There's a fractional difference in what would have been owed based on the statutes. A 1996 rate is different than a 1993 rate. But there was no problem with that because this is a perm total case. He was going to receive these benefits till the day he dies. So any overpayment made based on the 1996 rate could have easily been credited to any future payments at the 1993 rate. There are no practical problems in this case. It was just merely Shelby Insurance Company not wanting to pay, hoping to push the obligation onto a different insurance company, while AT Polishing sat idly by and did nothing. We sent three letters to...
Let me ask you, counsel, if they're advised, if opposing counsel is their representative, as he said he was, and is, and there is no independent obligation of AT Polishing to pay, that's what your opposing counsel said under 103.23.5. Now, you're saying that they have an independent obligation and you find that in the statute?
Well, I'm looking at the bad faith statute 102.18.1 sub BP, and that statute specifically allows for bad faith penalties to be assessed against the employer or the insurance company.
But doesn't that give you a choice? Where's the or both?
It is the third to last sentence in that subparagraph.
Okay.
Starts with the department.
Right. I see it. Thank you very much.
And the first sentence says the department may include a penalty against for an employee if it determines that the employer or the insurance carrier suspends or terminates or fails to make payment.
Counsel, is that consistent with other parts of the Workers' Compensation Act, too, when you're dealing with, if you will, penalties, that the words, whether it's for a bad faith failure to rehire or bad faith in delaying, bad faith in failing to rehire or unreasonable refusal to rehire under 102.35 or delayed payments under 102.23, that the wording is consistent with 102.18, that it can be against the employer or the insurance company, depending on the determination of who should bear the brunt of it?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And I can point to two statutes where it states that the employer is liable. The first one is 102.30 sub 4. And I'd like to state, before I even get into this, that the title of this is Other Insurance Not Affected, semicolon, Liability of Insured Employer. Defense counsel raised in his brief the issue that the distinction between an insured employer and an uninsured employer. I'd just like to point out that this statute is directed specifically to insured employers. Subsection 4 begins, regardless of any insurance or other contract, an employee or dependent entitled to compensation under this chapter may recover compensation directly from the employer and may enforce in his own name against the insurance company. This statute was looked at in the Miller Brewing case, which stated on point that financial arrangements between the employer and the insurers do not affect the employee. The employee may seek payment from either the employer or the insurer that insured the liability. The next statute section is right below it, sub 5, which states that payment of compensation under this chapter may be either by the employer or the insurance company. And to the extent that it is paid, it is offset.
Is a penalty defined as compensation under workers' comp?
I don't know if it is or not, Your Honor, but I was just merely pointing out that employers do have liability under the Act as a whole. Besides their express liability under the bad faith statute. Now, I'd like to just get back to the standard.
Counselor, before you leave that, I wanted to talk a little bit more about that express liability under the bad faith statute. You know, I look at the statute and I see what you mean, and I certainly see what you're saying about the obligation to make payment, but then I look at the administrative code and the provisions of the statute that require employers who don't qualify to be self-insured to actually have an insurance company. And I wonder if the duty to make payment in cases such as this is a duty that the statute permits the employer to delegate to the insurance company. Can you speak to that?
Well, I don't know how to answer that other than to say that this is the first type of case involving bad faith under these types of facts. As Lurk disclosed and all the courts have disclosed, there has not been any other facts or any interpretation of Statute 102.23 sub 5 on this point. So we don't know whether the employer must pay separately or force its insurance company to pay and to resolve the reimbursement issues later.
But if you look at the administrative code, DWD 80.70 sub 2, it says an insurance company or a self-insured employer who without credible evidence, and then it goes on to say that that's the standard for bad faith. So it seems to say that it's an employer who is self-insured or an insurance company, and I guess I have some concerns about whether that permits an employer, absent something aside from what we have here, which is really Shelby's position on the date of injury, to delegate this duty.
I am aware of that statute section, Your Honor, and I understand it as more or less a Deamer-type statute, meaning under this situation, as stated in the statute, that is to be deemed malice or bad faith for the purposes of finding bad faith. I do not think it is an overall standard that must be applied to all bad faith claims. This is an administrative code section which supplements the statute that we talked about earlier, which is directed to employer and or an insurance company and makes no distinction between self-insured employer or insured or self-insured employer.
Okay. Mr. Pitts, did Mr. Frohman try to bring in an insurance company?
He tried at the original hearing, Your Honor, yes.
And what happened there?
Well, the statutes do not permit an amendment or the additional parties to be added after the notice of the hearing is sent out. So from the ALJ's perspective, it was too late, and that issue should have been raised much earlier, so the ALJ just did not allow him to add another insurance carrier.
Did Mr. Bosco take a position on that?
Excuse me?
Did Mr. Bosco take a position on adding another, the Phantom Insurance Company?
No, because as I stated earlier, it makes no difference to Mr. Bosco. He looks at it as, I got hurt at work. There's no dispute about that fact, and I'm entitled to workers' compensation benefits. I don't care if Shelby pays it, if AT Polishing pays it, or insurance company X pays it, as long as I get what I'm entitled to under the Act. This Court should be aware that the fundamental purpose of the entire Act is prompt compensation for injured employees who are entitled to compensation, and all the statutes under the Act are to be liberally construed to effectuate that policy. That is well established in the case law. 102.23 sub 5 is directly on point to the facts of this case. I don't see how it is not. And it promotes that fundamental purpose. If an action for review is commenced, and the only issue on that review is who is going to pay the benefits for this employer that is not disputing the work-relatedness of the claim, then the employer must see that the injured employee is compensated. Any reimbursement issues between the employer and any insurance companies can be resolved at a later date.
And you think it should be the employer's responsibility rather than the insurance company's responsibility to cover this period of time when there's a date of injury that is being contested.
That is correct, Your Honor, because that is what the statute says. It says, shall not relieve the employer from paying compensation. It doesn't say the employer or insurance company or an insurance company. It specifically directs the statute to the employer. So that's why I believe it was AT Polishing's obligation to see that Mr. Bosco was compensated after there was no longer a dispute about its liability, whether AT Polishing paid it itself or demanded that Shelby pay it. I just would like to point out.
How big an employer is this?
I do not know, Your Honor. When this case was tried before the hearing, I was still an undergraduate student right down the street.
It's a passage of time that you're concerned about, right?
The most important thing to remember in this case is that even as early as the hearing before the ALJ, there was no dispute that this was an occupational injury case that AT Polishing owed. The only question was whether it was a 93 or 96 day disability, meaning whether Shelby must pay or some other insurance company must pay. From Bosco's perspective, it is ridiculous that he would have to wait another 26 months to receive those payments while Shelby fights about who is supposed to pay. It just directly conflicts with the fundamental purpose of the Act. It directly conflicts with 10223 sub 5, and it is unreasonable and irrational in the face of the facts of this case.
Now, you favor the Court of Appeals decision?
I do favor it because from the standard of review issue, it was very careful to only address the interpretation of 10223 sub 5. It did not usurp any power by LIRC. It specifically remanded the case to LIRC for a determination of bad faith. As you know, the bad faith test is whether there is an absence of a reasonable basis to deny the benefits and whether the employer or insurer had knowledge or recklessly disregarded that absence of a reasonable basis. The LIRC decision was based entirely on the interpretation of the statute. It determined that Shelby's interpretation was reasonable, and therefore the bad faith claim died because under the first step, if there's a reasonable basis, you don't need to go on. That was the only basis for LIRC's decision, and that was appealed. The Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals both noted that no, Shelby's interpretation, which LIRC accepted, was not reasonable. It was unreasonable. It directly conflicted with the plain language of the statute and the fundamental purpose of the Act, and was otherwise unreasonable, and remanded the case to LIRC to proceed on the bad faith issue with keeping in mind the fact that the statute means what it says, and it doesn't mean anything else, and that Shelby's interpretation of it was unreasonable. So I guess when it goes to LIRC, if that's what this Court chooses to do, the LIRC issue will be step two of the bad faith question, whether or not it had knowledge or recklessly disregarded.
Now, Counselor, let me ask you this. If you're right, and under 10223.5, whenever the insurance company wants to dispute payment for whatever reason, and liability's been determined, don't you give, generally in workers' comp cases, the same attorney represents the employer as represents the insurance company, but don't you put them in a conflict of interest situation if we were to agree with you and say, well, Shelby wants to do that, that's too bad, they can do that, it's really too bad for AT because they've got to pay right away. I mean, isn't there a basic conflict of interest then between having them both as a unified party, which is the way we're used to dealing with them in workers' compensation?
Right. I anticipated this question, and I thought about it often. I do believe there is a conflict of issue there. I do not suggest that anything unethical was done.
No, I didn't mean to imply that either. Just I know the way things are usually handled in workers' comp, and I can see that if I buy your argument, I've given opposing counsel a problem because he's representing two people that don't have a unity of interest in regard to the interpretation of the statute.
That is correct, and that is why in these occupational injury-type cases, if the underlying occupational injury is not disputed and the extent of that injury is not disputed, as we had here, and the only question is the date of disability for the purposes of determining which insurance carrier must pay, The obligation of the attorney representing both parties is to say, look, employer, my interests are now adverse to you because we have conceded that you owe, and we need you to find a new attorney to represent your interests, or at least find another attorney to represent the interests of the other insurance company and you. But, yes, I agree, there is a conflict there. And that's what I tried to point out in the briefs, is that these are two different companies, AT Polishing and Shelby. Though they may be represented by one counsel and appear at all the underlying cases and hearings together, they're separate. And one, the insurance company can't say, yes, our insured owes, but we don't feel responsible for it, so you're not going to get paid. That doesn't make any sense. If this were a tort case, obviously the insured would have to seek and obtain separate counsel from the counsel representing the insurance company.
Now, what's your view on the Brown case that came out after the decision of the Court of Appeals?
The Brown case, I do not believe, is controlling, and it is completely distinguishable from this case. In that case, there was evidence of improper investigation on behalf of the employer and the insurance company. So LIRC was addressing whether or not bad faith occurred with its expertise of the bad faith statute in general. In this case, we have a different situation because the bad faith claim is based on the statute, 1223 sub 5. And we're saying a violation of that statute, a blatant violation of that statute, subjects the employer and or its insurance company or both to bad faith penalties. So when LIRC was addressing the first test under the bad faith claim, whether or not there was a reasonable basis to deny the benefits, it was only looking at the statute. It wasn't looking at facts and using its expertise to determine whether or not this was bad faith. It was merely interpreting a statute. An interpretation of a statute is a question of law for the courts, as is the application of a statute to undisputed facts, which we have here.
Well, sometimes we give deference to an agency on interpretation of the statute if they've had experience doing it, if they've passed regulations, any number of reasons that we do. So why shouldn't they be granted deference here? After all, this statute is one, is in their bailiwick, right?
I'm sorry.
It's in their bailiwick. It's dealing with workers' comp, and they've had to apply it, 102.235.
Right. I think it wouldn't matter in this case whether you use great weight deference or apply to de novo review, and here's why. Under the great weight standard of review, an agency's conclusion is not controlling. It must still be reasonable, and as the Brown case pointed out, an agency's conclusion is unreasonable if it directly contravenes the express wording of the statute, if it directly contravenes the legislative intent or purpose of the statute, or if it is otherwise irrational. Under all three of those tests, this claim would be found unreasonable. First of all, it directly contravenes the plain wording of the statute, which couldn't be more on point, I don't think. Number two, it obviously violates the fundamental purpose of the entire act, which is to afford prompt compensation to injured workers who are entitled to that compensation. And thirdly, it is otherwise irrational. After AT Policing concedes that it owes Mr. Bosco benefits, but yet sits on the money and doesn't pay, that is unreasonable. So the agency's conclusion, even under the great weight standard, would not be controlling here, and this court would have to correct it. But I would submit to you that the appropriate standard of review should be de novo. As you know, the de novo standard of review is appropriate where the issue is one of first impression or where the agency's position is one that will provide no real guidance on the issue in the future. Everyone has admitted that this is a matter of first impression. LIRC has never before even looked at this statute before. There's no case law on it. So it is a matter of first impression. And secondly, LIRC's decision provides no real guidance in the future. LIRC said that this statute is susceptible to more than one interpretation and didn't explain what it thought the correct interpretation is. It merely stated that Shelby's interpretation was not unreasonable. So that leaves us nowhere. We're back to square one, and we don't know what the statute means. It provides no guidance, which is why this court should affirm the lower courts, which correctly interpreted the statute in accordance with its plain meaning and plain language.
Any other questions?
I believe I'm done.
No, yes, but if you wanted to say something, you have until your red light is on. But you don't feel obliged to take the time.
I will conclude. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Frohman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. On rebuttal, I would like to point out, I think, a basic problem with this argument today, and that is that the LURC has no authority to rule that liability exists for all potential dates of injury. Justice Bradley was concerned that it looked from the record that AT Polishing was the only employer around, so why shouldn't it be found liable for all potential dates? Well, LURC does not have the statutory authority to do that. It only has the authority to find that a given employer and a given carrier is liable based on a given date of injury. That's 102.03. I don't know how many times I've tried to assert throughout these proceedings that I never conceded that AT Polishing was liable for benefits. That did not happen. I was always defending AT Polishing from the perspective of my date of injury. When you look at the answer form, the so-called concession is simply an admission that the man was employed for the time he was employed. Time of employment doesn't determine date of injury. The answer doesn't even use the phrase.
I think I understand what you're arguing, but is that issue still open?
Which?
The issue about, in effect, what you conceded and
that, well,
isn't that over and done with and resolved and put
to bed? Justice, it has to do with the penalty case because the reviewing trial court and the Court of Appeals has repeatedly said that Shelby has no reasonable argument for denying these payments right away because it conceded benefits. And I'm trying to get across the point that the reason Shelby delayed in making these payments to Mr. Bosco following the commission order was that we still retained an argument that we were not liable.
But isn't that if the Court of Appeals case were affirmed, isn't that what the Court of Appeals anticipated was going to be the subject of the remand? Should bad faith be assessed here, and if so, against, you know, isn't that the future? Am I wrong on that?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals determined step one in the bad faith analysis. They said Shelby had no reasonable basis. It acted unreasonably. So all it left for the commission to do on remand was to figure out whether it knew it had no reasonable basis.
Yes.
And Shelby has been affirming its interpretation of this statute throughout. It would be a simple matter to say, well, certainly it knew. It's been arguing that way for a long time. And if they were arguing a totally unreasonable position all this time, they're in bad faith. And this, of course, gets to our question about, you know, does this statute really apply to this case? And here we have a record containing, testimony from a 30-year administrator of the department saying it doesn't apply. We have a department order saying it doesn't apply. And we have a commission order saying we're not sure if it applies, but it doesn't matter because the issue before us is bad faith. And since it's debatable, there's no bad faith. And that is the issue that went to the Court of Appeals on the penalty track, and the Court of Appeals reversed that decision improperly under the Brown decision. It certainly, the interpretation of this statute, 1929 statute, that has never been cited anywhere in 95 years except one footnote to this court's decision in the Miller Brewing Company.
Could you help me On 102.23.5, you say that does not apply to Shelby.
Does not apply to the circumstances of this case when there was no question as to liability between the employer and Shelby, certainly because Shelby admitted its coverage, and there was no dispute between multiple carriers because only one carrier was in the case.
Well, wait a minute. I don't think aren't you writing something into the statute?
Sorry?
Aren't you writing something into the statute? You're saying this is a dispute between Shelby and that insurance company behind the tree, that phantom insurance company. Isn't that a dispute about liability between several insurance companies?
The fact that this other insurance carrier may down the road be found liable and AT Polishing may be found liable for a 1993 date of injury, depends on another administrative proceeding. At the proceeding that you were asking about previously, the original benefit hearing, I suggested the medical evidence calls for another carrier to come into the case at this point. The administrative judge asks counsel for the applicant, do you agree? Do you want to come back later with this other carrier in the case? He says, no, we want to proceed against a 1996. We think that's the correct date of injury. The judge says, okay, let's go. That is the risk taken. If in fact the determination from the judge comes back and says it is 1993 and not 1996, that means AT Polishing and Shelby are dismissed. That means the applicant then refiles an application against AT Polishing and whoever it was. I think Century Insurance covered them before. But liability cannot be fixed for all potential dates of injury. It's not possible under the Act. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I think our difficulty is this. You've gone through a proceeding and you have been found to be liable. UAT and you, Shelby, right?
I'm sorry, Judge.
You've been found to be liable, substantively liable, on the merits. Right. And that's not before us.
Right.
But what you're saying, I think, let me see if I can't translate it. You're saying that before the appeal was decided, before all of your appellate rights were decided, there was a dispute between the employer there's no dispute between you and Shelby.
Right.
Between you and the employer. The dispute is whether or not there's another insurance company in this because 1993 is the kicker date, right?
Justice, there's no dispute that there is another carrier. That is correct. Whether the dispute is where liability attaches.
Right. But during the time that this is up on appellate review, right, you are disputing which of several insurance companies are going to be liable or whether the employer is going to be liable. Isn't that what the appeal was about?
I have a very selfish position on appeal, which is that my date of injury is not the right one. I don't care if another carrier is liable or isn't liable. That's not my fight. Mr. Bosco has the claim. He's got to pursue either multiple dates of injury or only one at a time at his desire. I on review of the commission benefit decision, I felt obligated to drop the factual finding of the extent of disability. I did concede at that point this is a factual finding. LURC has the authority to do this. The courts cannot change that. The man is 100% disabled from occupational disease.
The question on appeal was, where does the liability fall?
Right. That looks to me like it's under subsection 5.
But
because that's what the fight's about. Where is the liability? And that's a fight between the employer and the insurance company, or it's a fight between several insurance companies. So I don't quite get it.
But it's not with Mr. Bosco.
It's a fight between several insurance companies if they're all at the table as parties. And that's the way the department and the commission saw it, and I think we had a reasonable basis to argue that.
Okay. Your position is the insurance companies have to be in the lawsuit.
Yes.
And it's not a fight between you and AT. You're willing to cover them. If AT were liable, but AT hasn't been found liable for 93.
Exactly. And that resolves Justice Rogensack's question on the conflict of interest. Wouldn't there be a conflict of interest all the time in workers' compensation if Mr. Bosco's position is found to be correct? Yes, there would. And that's why there is no conflict of interest in this situation, because each carrier is responding to a particular date of injury on which the claim rests. Mr. Bosco wanted to prove his claim on a 1996 theory. That was my time, and my representation of the employer and the carrier are the same.
Can I just ask, and that was conceded and admitted? 1996 was conceded. You just said
we conceded that. We had the coverage in
1996. So this is what is confusing to me. You have a concession, and then you look, so there is liability. You look at the statute, 103.23.5, and just the plain reading there says that, okay,
yes.
you're not arguing about anything as far as Bosco is concerned. Bosco, this is an inter-family fight, I mean, between the insurance company and or AT Polishing. But as far as Bosco is concerned, under the statute, once there's been a concession and a finding, and that's what Judge Schrader said,
there is
an obligation to pay. And you're saying, no, there is no obligation to pay as long as there is an appeal ongoing.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's the point, that Judge Schrader said there was an admission that he was totally disabled. Therefore, there's no excuse not to pay benefits. And I think that is incorrect. We can concede that the man is totally disabled, and we can contest liability.
What does that do to the time is running, we've got a red light, but fundamentally that seems to run awry from the fundamental basis for workman's comp, which says once liability, then there is prompt payment.
It is, workers' compensation is certainly more prompt than civil litigation, but there are some necessary delays for due process. Yeah, that is inevitable. But thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frohman, and thank you, Mr. Pitts, for your argument this morning on a new approach to bad faith claims in workers' comp. That concludes our hearing in 03-0662, Bosco versus Lurk. The students will remain, and Justice Wilcox will be out shortly, and you will be joined by other students. We are in recess until 1:30.